So it's my pleasure to welcome Amos Clifford to Many Rivers Books and Tea to speak about the subject of this a little handbook of Shinjin-yoku. I received a little instruction in, because I noted when Amos came earlier that when he spoke the name, it was not Shinrin-yoku, which is what I had been saying, which is what it looks like in English. But
say it again.
Shinjin-yoku. Oh,
that's probably better than I said.
Yeah, that's really good. Yeah.
Anyway, but you can talk about it. And that's the point of your being here, in fact. Okay. So Amos Clifford started a Zen center in the Chico area 9 years ago and has been living here on Sonoma Mountain for the last 7 years. And has been leading these retreats. There's when you leave later, and I'll mention this again at the end, he's got some information here about upcoming events, a business card, etc. Come on in, Michael, and have a seat. And so please join me in welcoming Amos Clifford to Many Rivers Books and Tea.
Thanks. Thanks, Michelle. So, Shinjin-yoku. Actually, I hope I'm saying it right. You know, I met a young Japanese woman at Sonoma State, and we were talking about, you know, what she was here doing and what work I was doing. I said, well, I do this thing. I think it's called Shinrin-yoku. And she stands. She says, ah, Shinjin-yoku, like that. And she drilled me on it. And so it has, they don't really do like Shinrin. It has a kind of a almost a Z sound in there. And I think you're getting it pretty close. On the Shinjin-yoku.org website, I found a little audio file on the internet that says how to pronounce this. Right? So every now and then,
we should just play
it. We can just listen to it and see what it is. So I hope I'm getting it right. And the word, it's a Japanese phrase that was coined in the 1980s, really. So this is, we're not talking about an ancient Japanese, the ancient Japanese practice of Shinjin-yoku. And yet, there are many ancient strands that are available to us any time that we go into nature or into the forests for healing. And they're not just Japanese, they come from all over. We certainly have a strong set of traditions here in North America to draw on. You know, you think of Thoreau, for example, John Muir, people like that who really have found healing and, you know, just really a sense of, I don't know how to call it, maybe the deliciousness of life by simply spending time being present to whatever shows up in the forest. And what the Japanese did is their forestry agency, it was a bit of a public relations thing. Let's get more people into the forest. Let's develop more of a sense of connection to these forests we have. You know, Japan, an island nation, they've gone through periods in their long, long history of almost complete deforestation. There was a time in like around 900 something AD when the islands were almost stripped bare. You know, there are many sacred groves have survived that, but whoever the daimyo or the leader was at the time, you know, made a law. You cannot cut down trees from certain distance back from the ocean, certain distance from any of the rivers, and a certain distance up the mountain slopes. And it was pretty vigorously enforced. And I haven't gotten over there yet. We're working on organizing a field trip. We're hoping to take a group of people over there to experience their forest therapy trails. And I'm really looking forward to doing that. Now, I just use the term forest therapy, right? And Shinjin-yoku translates as forest bathing in the sense of taking in the ambiance of the forest. And as the Japanese Forest Agency has funded more studies, they've really done a great job of finding very clear markers of beneficial physiologic changes that come about when we spend even 2 hours just relaxing in a forest. And because these physiological markers are so strong and study after study have replicated them, they're actually shifting, they're having a trend towards just saying forest therapy, and that's congruent with a worldwide trend. And if you look at this in other countries, there's other countries that have similar practices. The Shingin Yoku, a very similar practice in South Korea, for example, and where they've set aside an entire large park, like a national park, that's a forest therapy park. When we go over to Japan, we're going to visit that and meet with the researchers there and so on. One of my advisors is a retired professor, a dean of forestry, and so he knows the minister of forestry in South Korea, and they're plotting together to set up a great tour for us. So I'm really looking forward to that, to going over there and learning from them what their traditions are, and to inviting them to come over and learn from us also. Because here we're developing a practice that is reflective of what our culture is, what our forests are like, and what maybe where our people need. That's certainly my aspiration, is to work with my colleagues in developing a practice that's truly relevant for what we're doing here, for what we need here. And I started doing this kind of work in, I think it was 1973, it might be 1974. When I was really young, I was 19 or 20, I had myself been on a outward bound type of, you know, expedition in the mountains that was very transformative for me. And at the time, I met some mentors, and one of my mentors was aware that I had a strong interest in native uses of plants, medicinal uses of plants that were native in the Santa Barbara area where I lived. I spent a lot of time wandering the mountains there and identifying plants, and when I couldn't identify them, I had a friend at the Santa Barbara Natural History Museum, Clifton Smith, who was quite a famous botanist, and I could take them in there and he would kind of teach me, you know, what they were. And I was so proud because I found a couple of plants that were hybrids he hadn't seen before, and so that was pretty fun. And so I was invited to take a group of kids from in the Santa Barbara Juvenile Hall up into the canyons, actually take them, these incarcerated kids, out of the juvenile hall and go up into the canyons with them and show them plants. And what we did is we went up there and I showed them, I taught them what I knew about plants, and I had each of them choose one and come back into the hall, and I had boxes of books, and I said, find three sources about this plant, draw a picture of it, write a couple of paragraphs. And they drew these beautiful, way far from anatomically correct, drawings of the plants. And they wrote their paragraphs, and the Santa Barbara County Office of Education published that, in 1,000 copies of a book called Useful and Healing Plants of the Santa Barbara Foothills by the Students of Villa Esperanza, which is the name of the school inside the juvenile hall there. And so that was, for me, beginning on this path of really being in what has been a lifelong inquiry about what is the role of our relationships with nature? How can we be in relationship with nature? What are the different doorways in to that kind of relationship? And really just going on an instinct that I'm sure everyone in this room shares. Right? It's good for us to be connected with nature. The findings of the Japanese studies, we're not surprised, but it's really good to have the evidence. So this is what I know. You know, I know that if I'm in the forest for 2 hours, just moving along slowly and mindfully, my blood pressure will be reduced. There's a thing called heart rate variability. That's an indicator of how well balanced the nervous system is. My heart rate variability will move towards in the direction that we want it to move. We know this. We know that the natural killer cell count, these are the cells that are like at the heart of our immune system. They're working in us all the time. If we're not getting cancer when we're in a cancerous environment, it's because our natural killer cells are in there working it. We know that when we go into the forest, that our natural killer cell count is going to increase. They're going to be happier little guys and working their job even harder. And we know also that if we use an instrument called Profile of Mood States, which is a widely used instrument internationally, very validated instrument, that our mood states will improve on the various subscales in there. Like one is called vigor, for example. We'll just have a more of a sense of vigor in our moods, right? And these are not things that we have to work to do. In fact, it's almost sort of the opposite. Like we have to, the more we don't work, the better these things happen. And the reason for that is that so much of these physiological effects are related to stress. So in our culture, we are so used to the background stress that we're under all the time that we may not even recognize it. You know, we evolved as a species with this wonderful nervous system adapted to short bursts of these stress responses that would give us the fight, flight, freeze syndrome, whatever we needed. That was so useful when we were, you know, bands of nomads out moving around on the prairies, and it's still incredibly useful to us. But the problem is that the triggers for that, we're immersed in them all the time. Traffic, you know, the telephone ringing, the different input, just constantly. So our bodies are always in this sort of imbalanced thing where the parasympathetic nervous system is too stimulated and the sympathetic nervous system is a little bit suppressed. A couple hours in the forest resets that, brings them back into balance, just naturally, unless we turn it into a stressful experience, right? So if I guide you into the forest and somehow I make it stressful for you, then I'm not working with the forest, right? So I spent a lot of years working at least part-time guiding and mostly adventure education, and then for a while I became a mountaineering instructor. So I was teaching, like, you know, mountaineering and ice climbing and rock climbing and, you know, backcountry skiing, kind of the jock way of being in nature. And that's a beautiful way of being in nature, just to go back there and to find our edges and to find the adventure and to really push that. That can really expand our sense of who we are. I think it was really good for me in a lot of ways, but that's not the practice we're talking about with Shinjin Yoku, right? And then also in a lot of those years, I spent time when I had opportunity educating myself as much as I could, as much as I was willing to pay attention, I think is what's true, about just naturalist knowledge. You know, what are the species? What are the relationships to each other? What is their role in the ecosystems? Really important stuff to know. And that's not what this practice is about either. And then I've also spent a lot of time just going out and hiking. You know, just that good exercise, getting my heart rate up, right? Let's see if I can cover 8 miles today, 10 miles. Now, you know, lately it's been more like 4 miles. And just, you know, that good sense of cardiovascular workout and getting a good sweat, and what a wonderful thing that is to do. And that's not this practice either. So in a way, what we're bringing in with this Shinjin Yoku is we're bringing in another way that's a little bit unusual for us in our culture. Like when we think about going to nature, we tend to think of hiking boots, right? So, and some kind of nature uniform that we do, and for many people that's immediately a barrier. Like if someone wants to find a group activity to go into nature, they may feel like there aren't a lot of choices that really work for them. So I'm thinking of a woman I had on a walk about a year ago, and she registered online to go on the walk, and then she called me and she said, Amos, I am morbidly obese. And I said, And, well, do you feel like you could walk on level ground for a quarter mile? She said, I think I can. Do you ever get out and walk? And she said, no. And I said, well, if you're willing to try this, we'll just pay really close attention. And she came up and she did a walk. She walked a quarter mile with us. She had to rest about 7 times in that quarter mile. And the whole group organized around the pace that she needed, which was actually a pretty good Shingen Yoku pace. It's nice and slow, very restful, and supported her. And she had this really powerful experience of coming back into nature. And that's kind of extreme. It was actually a little scary to me before we got back to the car, but she made it fine. I checked with her via email a couple days later, and I said, well, are you going for walks in your neighborhood now? And I wish I could say yes, that she said yes, but she said no. She was still scared even to go out into her neighborhood. But this was a practice that was accessible to her. And that feels really good to me, you know, that it's highly accessible. And so I think what I should do is maybe describe a little bit about what the practice is, at least as we are doing it here in the United States and as we are teaching it. And I want to say I'm using this term we. Maria right here is my co-trainer when we're training guides. She's a very gifted guide, with very deeply nature connected, with a lot of lineage and nature connection that I'm a little bit envious of. So, and I also want to acknowledge my partner, Michelle, who's just really supports this whole project and may have a story herself. I don't know. We'll see if later on there's room for a story from her. And so what we do on the practice is, first of all, imagine a trail. It's nice and level. It's under forest canopy, except it comes out into little meadow areas every now and then. And at the beginning of this trail, there's a nice, comfortable restroom. And you took a nice preemptive restroom break there, so you're kind of free of worry. We come at the beginning of this trail and we gather in a circle and we just connect a little bit with each other. And then what we really do is connect with our senses. So we do something that's, if you've been involved in mindfulness meditation, you may have done body scan. We do something that's similar to that. What we do is we cycle through really just the basic 5 senses. Just first being present, being aware of where we are. Oh, this might take 20 minutes. We're just doing this. Already it's a little edgy for people. There's a paradox in here, right? We want to de-stress, but going slow is stressful. It is, because we're addicted to going fast, you know, and then we come, wow, we're going really. So we do this check-in, and one of the things that I really like to do in this is invite people to maybe, you know, we pick up a stone from the creek bed and we just say, you know, old one, will you please hold this worry for me while I'm on this walk? Do we think of what kind of worries we might distract us while we're on the walk? We make a little, lately we've been making a little circle with our stones and using that as a threshold that we step through when we begin the walk. So that might take like 20 minutes or so, maybe a little shorter sometimes. And then we walk slowly, and I'll set the pace when I'm guiding. Whoever's the guide will set the pace in the beginning. And we do this really simple thing. We simply pay attention to what's in motion in the environment. And I invite you all to do this sometime. Go to Regal Park or something. Just walk slowly, paying attention to what's in motion in the environment. Give that a good 10 minutes, good 10 or 15 minutes. It really helps me to walk like this. I'll be walking slowly like this, and something will catch my eye, and I'll just pause and let it catch my eye. And then I'll move on, and those little pauses help me stay slow. Otherwise, it tends to speed up, right? So those little pauses really help. And once we've done that, we'll usually circle up, and we use a talking piece and we pass it around, and the question is really simple: what are you noticing? And you know, we may be now about 100, 200 yards into our walk. it's taken a half hour or so to get that far. And when people start sharing what they're noticing, I have three experiences in that. One is, I noticed that too. Another one is, I noticed that too, but I didn't notice that I was noticing it. Right? It's like bringing me present to my own awareness because someone else was present to that. And the third one is, I didn't notice that. I'm really curious now. And so we'll do that, and that won't take, you know, depending on the group size, it won't take that long to do that before we move into another invitation. So we call all of these things invitations. They're not exercises or assignments. And the instruction given for any of these invitations is, it is an invitation. If you find yourself efforting to do it well, let it go. Because honestly, just being in the forest is enough. That's true. And the contradictory truth that lives in balance with is, as a people, we've forgotten how to just be in the forest. And so that's the point of having a guide, is a guide can help you come back home. You know, what I like to say is that the guides open doors, these invitations for opening doors. The doors are very specifically sensory. They're with our senses. We're experiencing, moving away from anything that's cognitive. We're moving as closely as we can to pure sensing. Just with the basic five senses, but I'd say the five senses plus, because there's other senses that kick in. The guide opens the doors, the senses. The forest is the therapist. So the forest is always there. The forest is what's going to be doing the healing. So then we move into another invitation, depending on what the group is. We might do two more invitations. We might do one that focuses really on just the sound. You know, what's the day like? Does the day have a really interesting and pleasurable soundscape? And I really like to, in the invitations when I give them, I really like to invite people to notice where the pleasures are in the environment. It's a little bit scandalous, right? It's a little edgy for some people, like, oh, like the pleasure of the wind on my skin, and I'm supposed to let that in, right? It's interesting. People will say, wow, that was a little stressful for me, pleasure. Like I felt it was a little naughty somehow, right? And what a comment that is on something. I'm not sure what. But, and when I talk about that, you know, like if we're letting, like if we're feeling the wind on our skin, maybe this is what makes it a little edgy, is because I like to use this metaphor. Think of what it's like to touch the face of someone who you love. What is that like? When you're letting that, when you're having that experience, you're not going through, at least the major component of that is not an analysis of the textures with a running commentary on it. The experience is felt through your whole body. And it's a good experience. Just feels good. And we can be in relationship to the breeze the same way. We can step outside on a day when there's a sun or when there's a fog blowing, and we can feel that and be open to it and let it in into our body. Right? So this is the sensing below the sensing. This is the felt sense of presence that's completely embodied when we're going out there, right? So we may do two or three more of those, and then typically what we'll do after that is we'll do either a wander or a sit spot. So wander, usually we will have a little invitation to do something. A real typical wander is to go and have a conversation with the tree. Think of a question you're carrying or something. Go be with the tree, and we'll give some a little bit of framing around how do you have a conversation with the tree. Sounds pretty crazy, right? Trees don't talk. And I have many people say, I don't do that. And they go out and do it and they come back. And I've learned to call the conversation with the tree. I've learned to call that particular invitation the gateway of grief. As people come back crying. Because there's something that happens in us when we start reconnecting with nature. We encounter grief. We encounter a grief that's simmering inside of us all the time. And this is a really common experience. In the nature connection community that Maria is more embedded in than I am, they actually refer to it as the river of grief. And they say that's one of the barriers for people getting nature connected. As they start getting nature connected, they encounter that grief and boom, they don't have the support to go through it, so they turn away. And so we try to, you know, part of our work is to just welcome it. And maybe to name it if it needs to be named, and to really give it its place of honor. And to really honor that grief when it comes up. In many walks, grief doesn't come up. I'd say about half the walks I do, grief shows up in some very visible, significant way. Sometimes it's just pure joy and wonder is all that's showing up. Right? So we'll do the wander again. We'll have a little council, and then as we're going along the trail, we're foraging plants. This is part of the Japanese tradition for sure. If we're not doing anything else that's in the Japanese tradition, we're doing this. We're foraging plants, and then we brew tea out of those foraged plants. And then we have a little tea ceremony at the end. And so the tea ceremony, I mean, if you're thinking like, nice Japanese tea ceremony, it doesn't look like that. It's like I've got a camping stove and some plastic cups, and we pour the tea in there. The main thing for the ceremony that I ask is that everyone keep a poker face until everyone's had their first sip. Because I don't want to prejudice the first sip of anyone else by taking that sip and go, oh, you know, or whatever it is. And as we're having this tea ceremony, we're actually taking in the land that we've been on. It's another deep form of sensory connection. The teas that we brew out of these multiple plants are very complex. They have like, first you get one taste in your mouth, then another taste, and then there's a peppery feeling at the bottom, the back of your throat, and then something else comes up, right? So it's a very sensory thing, very immersive in the medicine of the plants of the land that we've just been on. So that's part of the guide training, is that, you know, be very sure about the plants you're using. And that every now and then I'll get people saying, you know, I heard that if you put poison oak into you, it'll help you build immunity. And I'm like, yeah, maybe, but not on my walk. Right? So, speaking of tea, gratitude for the tea. Thank you for brewing this for me. So, what happened for me was as I continued in my work and my questioning about, you know, what is my medicine and what do I want to do with my life, and in particular as I'm entering my elderhood, what do I want to do with my life, it just seemed really clear to me that we're in a very critical time right now. Like, I feel like I don't have time, we don't have time to mess around with, you know, the old story about how we're supposed to live. We're in critical times right now. And so I hold the story that all of the efforts, everything we're doing to try to figure out how to be sustainable, if we're doing that from outside of relationship with nature, there will be subtle flaws in it all and it will be undone. That the trees can tell us what it is we need. The waters can tell it is what we need. They can tell us how we need to live. The breezes can tell, the birds can tell us. This is how it was for humans for forever until recently in our evolution. And my sense then is that we need to reconnect with that. We need to come into deep relationship. So a few years ago, I was really carrying this question, like, how can I, as someone who carries the medicine of a guide, that's one of my medicines that I carry as guide, what can I do to connect as many people as possible with nature in a significant way? I came across this literature on Shinjin Yoku, right? They've integrated it into their healthcare system. I started wondering, what would it be like if we mobilized the largest referral network in this country to connect people with nature? What would that be like? I'm talking about the big healthcare system and all the healthcare providers. What would it be like if we got them out into nature? So that's when I decided to found this organization. It's called the Association of Nature and Forest Therapy Guides and Programs. That's the name of it. The mission of the association is to integrate nature connection wellness practices into the healthcare system in the United States and beyond. That's the mission, right? Simple little project. But I have some models for that, right? MBSR, mindfulness-based stress reduction. Like 15 years ago, some guy knew Vipassana and started doing it in a hospital. And now it's spread. It's got, in fact, this year it's really taken off in a really big way. Think of yoga. How long ago was it that yoga was some weird thing? And now it's very much embraced as a mainstream way of maintaining wellness and feeling good. And so we're at the beginning of that with this forest therapy. And one of the strategies to help achieve this mission of integrating forest therapy, and through that nature connection, and through that the dawning of the wisdom maybe that nature can offer us, one of the strategies is to train guides. So one of the first things we did is I drafted a set of standards. What should a forest therapy guide know and be able to do? And I put that out into the field with some of my colleagues who are guides and my advisors and got input, and we came up with these standards. Okay, so what we do next is we develop a training program that teaches people to these standards, where they then, after the training, go on a practicum. They take this back home. They demonstrate their competence in a mentored practicum. With Maria's in charge of our mentoring program on this, and has several mentors that are real, you know, deeply nature connected people. And when they've done that, then we certify them. We certify that they've completed that training. So my hope is then that physicians or other healthcare providers will feel a sense of confidence. Like, here are some people who can do this with you in a good way. Right? They can take you out and make sure that you have a safe experience. It's a healing experience that'll support your wellness. And a very low cost experience. Right? So that's the strategy. One of the strategies. Oh, I've been so surprised by things as things have unfolded. A couple of things. One is, a couple of months ago, the Green Spa Network named forest bathing the number one trend for spas for 2015. Right? So I get a call from these people in Sedona that have L'Auberge de Sedona, luxury spa. Say, Amos, will you come out and train our staff? And I don't want to do the whole 7-day guide training. They didn't want that. They just wanted their staff to be able to guide just on one trail. So we got together and developed another certification, a 3-day training with a little mentored practicum that's called Place-Based Forest Bathing Facilitator. It's just for this place where we're training in. We work extensively on that trail. I train their yoga teachers. Yoga teachers are already very embodied. They already know how to teach. In 3 days, they got the basics. It was still edgy for them. The last day we had journalists from like Yoga Journal and Style.com and showed up in the afternoon, and these yoga instructors I had just trained gave them a forest bathing experience. Really edgy for them, and I had complete confidence in their ability to do that well. So that's been a surprising development, right, in this. And another one that's very local that's a really sweet development is, for a lot of my career, I've done work in schools, and in the last 7 years or so, I've done a lot of work with, particularly with restorative practices, community building based on the principles of restorative justice in schools. And so I have good relationships with a number of school districts around the state. Well, Santa Rosa City Schools, one of the assistant soups there got in this conversation with me about this. It's in their wellness committee right now. What they're proposing is to contract with the organization so that any of their staff can go out on these walks. And then I just build a district, right? That's like the first employee wellness program using forest bathing probably in the nation, as far as I know. And it's a huge surprise to me. So part of what I'm feeling from these surprises is the time is right. There's a real sense like we're ready as a people to embrace this, and so I feel really grateful for that because of how the doors I hope will continue to open. Now, one of the things that we do is we have ongoing walks and some flyers over there, and they list some of the walks that are scheduled, and we also have 7-day training intensives for people who are on the guide path, and we also have a 2-day introduction to guiding for people who just want to learn what guiding's about. And so we do that here in Sonoma County, and Sonoma County is kind of the lab for us, where we keep trying different things and seeing what's working. One of the cool experiments we're in right now is we're partway into what we're calling the spring immersion. So that's a group of people signing up to do 7 walks together in 7 weeks. And we started, this Saturday will be our 3rd week, so you can see, you can just feel the land waking up. And one of the beautiful things on this is to come back to the same trail week after week and watch that process, to be really immersed in it. And so, and for me, part of the inquiry with the 7-7 project, the immersion, is what is it like to go through this with a group, right? Because most walks I have, every walk is a whole different group. New people show up. So that's been a really sweet inquiry here lately also. And we have a training, another wonderful opportunity is Morton Arboretum in Chicago. Now this is like one of the premier arboretums in the world. Amazing place contacted us and said, will you come and do one of your 7-day trainings here? So we're doing that in June. The first week of June, we're going to be doing a training. And it's just one of their, they just set it up as one of their classes. They're just having us come out and do the training. At the end of that time, I anticipate that Morton Arboretum will have the first designated forest therapy trail in the United States, right? In Japan, there's something like 50 of them right now. They call it the Forest Therapy Road. Japan, they have 5 training centers. What I want to see somewhere between 5 and 10 years from now, I want to see a dozen training centers in the United States. I want to see 200 forest therapy trails. I want to see a whole forest therapy circuit. I want to see hospitals building forest therapy trails. You don't need a long distance, a quarter mile's plenty, right? You don't even need that. I was doing some over here at a retirement center, and many of the people who came were on walkers, and we had wonderful forest therapy experiences going to their raised garden beds where they were growing a variety of plants. And they had this old grandmother oak growing nearby. And we did walks there. We interacted with the plants, right? Oh, it was there was something a little heartbreaking. It's just they were touching the plants, you know, I was saying, yeah, touch them and see, you know, what do they smell like, you know? Maybe break off a leaf and taste it. And the heartbreaking thing was couple of them commented, I've never touched these plants before. I thought I wasn't allowed to. Right? No, touch the plants. Take them in. I mean, it's good to know which plants are which, because there are a couple of plants out there that you don't want to take in. There's this plant called hemlock that even a little bit is more than he can handle, right? But they're very rare. They're the exception.
Wild nettle.
Nettle's great if you throw it in hot water. We have nettle in our tea a lot, but I feel it in my hand for the next 24 hours. Right. I also go and pick it really carefully, like I try to fold the leaf over and just kind of but I get it on me. Right. You know it's medicine for arthritis? You take that sting, like say you have arthritis in your knuckle, boom, sting it with some nettle. Right? It's going to be stingy, but I haven't gotten to experience this directly because so far, you know, thankfully, I'm not experiencing arthritis. But this is like a reliable report from all over the world with nettle, right? So this is an important kind of guide thing, is to know like how to use them too. There are plants out there that are medicinal plants that if I have women on the walk of childbearing age, they don't go in, you know? So it's kind of looking at who's on the walk and what goes in. So this is all kind of part of the training, is to figure that out. Yeah. I think I want to kind of just wrap it right there. I wonder, Michelle, if you would like to share a little bit. Michelle's come on a couple of these walks with me, and I wonder if you'd like to share a little bit of what your experience was like, kind of next, what the walk was like, and then the next day noticing that you had.
Well, I'm both a graphic designer, so I spend a lot of time at a computer.
Come up so they can hear you? Yeah, thanks.
I'm a graphic designer, and I spend a lot of time at the computer. And also, since 05, I've been dealing with Lyme disease. It's finally got diagnosed in 2012. I'm on my way towards healing, happy to say, but it creates a lot of anxiety about being in nature, and I still have it, you know. But I've found when I've gone on these walks, that anxiety is countered by the calmness, and your mind, it's like a meditation, although it's not addressed as such, because Amos doesn't want people to go, okay, we're meditating now, and then the effort that people think, oh, I have to act like I'm meditating, then all of a sudden that makes you self-conscious about your experience. And so he rules that out and makes sure he doesn't use any words that can, you know, make one have that attitude while you're walking or experiencing the space. It decompresses you. And in terms of if you have any kind of chronic pain, there's this reaction to having pain. It's like flinching and squinting. Your body is just always like this, you know, against the pain. And that somehow the experience goes in and kind of interrupts that automatic response and creates a little bit of a buffer. So when you finish that thing that's always there, just quiets down, and that's what I experienced. So in both times, it's like, oh, that's what this is supposed to be doing. Amos has been talking about
this
it.
This is what I've been trying to tell you.
Yeah. I mean, let alone obviously not being at a computer helps, but just it was a really lovely experience.
Thank you, Michelle.
Thank you
for that. That was actually a very beautiful explanation that I just learned a couple things from. So thank you for that. Maria, is there anything that I've left out that you would like to add, or what would you like to say about this?
Well, I can just say what's been with me recently, what's coming up for me. Yeah, just to share what's been coming up for me recently. Hi. Is that sometimes a lot in my life I've walked around and looked at the world around me and seen like a lot of disconnection and kind of lost hope for various reasons around that at different times, and then doing this work and some other work I'm doing in my life, and I see it in particular in this work, is that our tender humanness is like just under the surface. It's like through simple things, really. Like, for example, I was on a walk last Saturday on Valentine's Day, a Shinrin-yoku walk, and I wasn't leading it. One of our guides in training was leading it, but there was a man on it, and in our introductory circle, he said, I'm the last person that you would normally find on one of these walks, but I'm just here to support my sweetie because she really wanted to come and it's Valentine's Day, and so I wanted to spend time with her. And he was just like, I'm a city slicker and I'm not comfortable with this kind of thing, you know, and because, you know, some feelings were starting to come up. And then a little while into the walk, there was that invitation of like, introducing yourself. Well, it's introduced as you know, when we come into anybody's house, the polite thing to do is to introduce yourself to the people that are there. And so when we come into the forest, the polite thing to do is to introduce yourself. And there's so much research behind now showing how the ecosystem is all connected, so that when we introduce ourselves to one piece, whether it's a tree or a rock or a fallen log or anything we connect with, that we introduce ourselves to that whole forest we're coming into. And so we all went off to do that, and he came back, and we had a little sharing circle about it, and he just said, oh, I didn't do that, I didn't introduce myself. But when I was out there, it occurred to me that maybe it was okay to just be. Mm. And he was like, and that's really new for me, and you could see the tears were, you know, about to come, and it was just so beautiful that, what, you know, it comes to people in different ways, and he didn't go through the invitation, and yet, you know, we talk about the imaginal sense, like when we introduce ourselves, like is there a response back, is there an image that comes or a thought or anything. And so I felt like he had that experience, and to me it's just such a reminder that no matter how much we might walk through life and not taking that time to connect, or maybe, you know, pushing down our feelings to get on with life, that really our tender humanness is just there, and through really simple things we all just come so alive, and that's very hopeful for me and really inspires me about this practice. Yeah.
Thank you, Maria.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful story. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's sweet. Yeah. You had told me that before, that story, and it didn't quite land. And I feel it now. Yeah, thank you.
And I've seen that many times. That's just one recent example, but I see that over and over again.
I was just looking at the clock, and I want to just double check. Is the intent to be done around 8:30? Is that?
No, between 8:30 and 8:45.
So okay. All right. So we're still doing pretty good. So yes, yeah, so I want to just name one other thing, just based on what Michelle brought up. You know, she said that it's meditative, but in the way that I like to do the practice, I don't like to say that in the beginning, because I think in our culture we carry a lot of stories about what meditation is, and people will immediately start efforting, right? And that efforting is sort of counterproductive. My own history includes 25 years of pretty serious Zen practice, and which I'm kind of post-Zen now. I like nature connection. I think if the Buddha was sitting where when he was enlightened? He was under a tree, and he was wandering around where while he was in the forest. You think that's a, you know, irrelevant fact? I don't think so. I don't think so. I think that these living beings out there, and I am talking about the living individual trees, but I'm talking about this living entity called forest. It's a powerful place. Right? And so we just do simple sensory connection. I can tell you this, when you're you know, our minds tend to be like off in the future, back in the office at home with some worry or something. And when you're just simply noticing how the touch of water, your hand in the stream, is feeling in your body, you are in a state of deep mindfulness automatically. And this just happens automatically along the trail. And almost inevitably, someone will say, "Wow, this is just like meditation, isn't it?" I say, "Oh, is it? Oh, that's interesting." So this is part of the fun of being a forced therapy guy. So now, yeah, questions or comments? Yeah.
Yeah, I was interested in your comment about grief. And I guess the question I have is the grief that you find that you and other people encounter in this practice something primordial in us, or is it more of a grief that arises from the disconnection or the imbalance of the lifestyle that we live now?
I don't know that I really understand it, and my sense of it's that it's both of those, you know. Like there's some really deep grief, but I think also that just we carry a huge grief as a people, the loss that we're embedded in. I mean, the species that are dying, the forests that we're losing, I was listening to NPR like a week ago, and someone was on there talking about villagers in Afghanistan and how they were explaining that to them the sky had always been a place of incredible beauty and joy and sustenance. And because of the drones now, they lost their relationship with the sky. It had become a place of foreboding. Right? Think of the grief of that. That's in Afghanistan. I feel that grief here. Right? And yeah, so I think it's just, I'm thinking, I came onto campus here in Sebastopol, where I was doing circles with kids, you know, and these four little girls ran up to me. I was there a little early, and they said, Amos, let's go have a circle with those boys up there because they're trying to kill the gophers. You know, let's talk to them about killing the gophers. And so I said, well, we'll invite them. And we went up there, and they, nah, we don't want any of that. We want to kill the gophers and play football. I said, well, so they don't want to be in a circle. You girls want to have a circle? Yeah. So we sat down around this gopher hole, and we started a circle, and those girls went so deeply into grief that that's what was up for them. You know, the gophers as a doorway into that. You know, these are like fourth grade, I'm pretty sure, fourth or fifth, something like that. I just think it's really, and we have a culture that doesn't have very many containers for that. It's a little different here in Sonoma County because there are grief ceremonies, community grief ceremonies on a fairly regular basis around here, right? Sabanfusel May comes and does grief ceremonies through the Weaving Earth program and maybe some other, and I know there's other people that do that, but by and large, as a people, we don't really have a way of knowing grief. Well, the forests know. The forests invite our grief. They know how to heal it. Right? I had a very moving experience with a tree when I was in Sedona actually doing this training. I was leaning against a tree and I was just trying to connect, and I came to this place. I had asked it a question about healing. Like, what really will support my healing? I came to this place of really deep silence and stillness inside. And I was just experiencing that. I wasn't really making anything of it. And then I heard the tree speak. And the tree said, that place of stillness, that's where your healing is. It all comes from there. It's always there. And when you can't find it, the tree said, come to us. Right? Made perfect sense to me. Yeah. What else? Yeah.
I've been studying for a long time the relationship between words and nature. And I've learned that the study itself brings me there. Mm. And that if I'm not looking at the relationship between my between words and nature, speech removes me. Speech itself removes me. So I've learned that nature is the language of everything. And that bringing words into relationship with nature is bringing them home, mm-hmm. is bringing words themselves home. And doing that brings me to a meditation which is beyond meditation, because it's not excluding speech or words or that's what I've been looking at, and that's why I'm here tonight, as you talk about.
Yeah. Thank you for that. What an eloquent job of using words to describe the wordless.
Well, it's really interesting, because I just came back to something that actually started me on my journey, and it was two really simple sentences. It was, thank you silence for making a place where words can live. And that could just as easily be, thank you nature for making a place where words can live. Thank you words for making a way for hearts to speak. And it's kind of like a circle, and it's all about coming home.
Yeah, and this is, we share that feeling, you know. It's like it's home. It's right there.
And home has its own language.
And I think this is also part of the experience of grief. It's like having been homeless for so long, in a way, finally we're home. And the grief comes really strong. I'm feeling really gratitude that this recorder was rolling just now, because I just love how you articulated that. Yes.
I would appreciate you talking about reciprocity with the forest. Mm-hmm. I was here early and had a chance to mm-hmm. glance at the book, and I really loved what indication you gave of your awareness of mm-hmm. that.
Yeah. Well, one of the experiences that I have with the forest is, you know, the more I do this practice, the more I feel a sense of really relationship, really being in relationship. And relationships work when they're reciprocal, right? And part of what comes to me from trees, and this is, you know, Maria referred to the imaginal sense, and this is not one of our regular five senses, but it's the sense we all have, and it's the sense that allows us to have that contact, that communication with other than human species. And part of what comes to me through that is that the trees love us, and they are so happy that we're showing up again. It's like I have been waiting so long. You know, and they're tender, and they're like trying to help us along. I mean, the story I like about why forest bathing is taking off so much right now is because the trees are spreading the word. I mean, I like that story, right?
Yeah.
Now, the reciprocity, right? So part of that is the being with. So think of anyone who you love, just being with them, just giving them generously of your time. So sit spot, you know, just finding a place to sit for 20 minutes and just be present is a giving of attention. Another part of that is tending, you know, Same with tenderness. People say, what do you mean by tending? I mean, just be tender with places. And so we encourage people on these walks to go home and find something to tend, even if it's just a flower pot, you know, and be tending along the trail too. You only find a little piece of trash, pick it up. But another really core practice is gratitude, just giving gratitude, beginning and ending with gratitude. And so starting often in our first circle, you know, a guide will typically say, you know, I'm noticing that the plum flowers have opened today, and I'm feeling really grateful for that. Is anyone else feeling that? Yeah, feeling that. And just making that space for gratitude to come in. All the ears out there are listening, right? They're all listening. And so that's some of the reciprocity, you know. And I feel like my answer is like so small, like, but the main thing for me, the main thing is to love, right? And so I have this whole big scheme about getting the healthcare system to refer people so we can get them into nature connection. But honestly, I just want us all to be in love with the world, right? But just be in love with it. And, you know, Jacques Cousteau said, people protect what they love. Right? And I just read another thing about educating children. It said, begin with love. Help them find their love. The learning will follow. You know, if you love something, you're going to learn it, right? And so, and when we are in this love, this deep love, this sensory love, you know, it becomes sensual love when we're really connected with the land. Then we do treat it with tenderness and respect, and we walk on it in a different way with a different awareness. Does that seem
yeah,
like...
Yeah, I mean, I'm real involved in this viewpoint as well. I just wanted to hear you talk about it. And I also think that you know, that part of our lostness is that we allowed ourselves to be separated from the awareness that it's all alive, it's all alive, and it's all sentient. And the indigenous world knows that. So I heard Jerry Mander say, you know, the world at this point is divided into the ones who think everything is alive and aware and conscious, and those who think that it's not. And those who think that it's not think that those who think it is are idiots, you know, whatever. I mean, to me, part of this healing, this great healing that that you are dancing with, and many people are dancing with in various strands of it, has to do with that, you know. But you're dealing with people who feel foolish being invited to talk to a tree,
yes.
Right? So,
yes.
I mean, one of the things I'm wondering is if I have the patience at this point in my journey. I mean, to tend that. I mean, part of me really wants to sign up for your training, and part of me thinks I'm only got the patience for it at this point. Better that I just do my juju with the trees and go at it that way.
Yeah.
But I love that. Mm. I love what you just said. That really love is what's informing all of it. And
yes.
I love hearing that.
Yeah, thank
juju.
You. Thank you for that.
Juju.
I just, true spirit work, yeah.
You know, I've encountered, since I've started doing this work, I've encountered so many people. I'm surprised how many people have incredibly strong connections with trees and tree energy and tree spirits. And it's like there's a huge tribe out there.
Well, you know,
yeah.
You mentioned Savan Fu, you know, Melodoma was one of my teachers,
yeah.
And the Dagara, who I've spent quite a bit of time with, they believe that the trees are the highest beings on the planet.
Mm. Yeah.
I mean, there are many people on the planet who know that, and I agree with you, you know, that the trees are maybe running things now. They're getting enough energy back to do that.
That feels really good in my body to hear that. You know, in Naladoma's book of Water and the Spirit, his story of encountering the tree spirit was very moving. It's probably, for me, one of the most vivid scenes in that book. Mm-hmm. So.
And he has a beautiful thing. One of the reasons that they're the highest beings on the planet is that they don't speak out loud. It's somehow it's woven into the beauty of your wisdom.
He said many native traditions teach that speech is a curse.
One of our advisors on the project is Alerian Merkuliev, who's a Aleut elder, and he likes to tell it. You may have, if you go to Bioneers, he often speaks there, and you may have heard him tell the story of how he was raised by an uncle who mentored him, and he said in 17 years of education he spoke maybe 100 words and his education came that way. So yeah, it's very much congruent with what you're saying. I see we've got like another 5 minutes, so maybe
I just have a quick question. I'm a bit of an amateur photographer, and so just seeing the plum trees, the trees, the beauty of the trees now, and then you'll see the mustard and you'll see the daffodils coming. When I look at these beautiful purple trees, I actually want to weep. And so when you're talking about grief coming up, follow up on this, what do you do if someone is overwhelmed with, sort of breaks down during one of your...
Yeah,
I'm not a speaker, so I'm...
No, I get it. I get it. What do you do?
How do you tend that? How do you hold that?
For me, it's like I bear witness and welcome it. You know, I feel gratitude toward it. I don't try to change anything about it. I feel gratitude when people are going into that grief. I feel like they're doing work for all of us, for me. So, and I know it's going to pass. Like, they're going to let out just as much as they can let out. And then they're going to, like, get it together and move on. And whatever happened, I always feel it serves. So that's my approach, you know. It's... The last thing I want to do is try to comfort someone out of their grief. No.
Do they often share with you what... going on in their minds, or is it primarily a private?
I would say sometimes, probably more often than not, because they'll come back and we'll have a round with the council piece, and people will tell stories about what came up for them. And a lot of times, being with the trees will connect them with loved ones who they've lost or ancestors who they've lost. So it just seems to spontaneously happen, and a lot of times it'll connect us with our own mortality, you know, and so there's just a real tenderness in there. Yes.
I'm thinking to share two things. One is I haven't heard Joanna Macy mentioned tonight, but she's dealt an awful lot with this experience of grief in the state of the world. Do you know her?
I don't have a strong connection with her, but Maria is a facilitator in the work that reconnects. So it's in there, yeah.
So then for myself personally, I also wanted to say, I'm familiar with a lot of the roots, I think, of where you're coming from, but I heard several things tonight that really made connections for me. And I was reminded of this story, slightly edgy, as you say. one year at Halloween, and Halloween is my birthday, but I was strongly motivated to dress as a tree. And I did that, and I also ate psilocybin mushrooms. And I went to this dance in an unfamiliar town. I didn't know anybody. And I was there with my husband, but I ate mushrooms, and I was a tree. And immediately, I took on the mantle of a tree. I couldn't speak. Like, I lost my voice. And I went into this dance, and I just stood there. And people were dancing, but I couldn't move. I was rooted. And I started to really strongly experience what it was like to be a tree. And one of the pieces was that I could sway a little bit, but I couldn't move my feet. And also that I wasn't speaking or really looking to relate to people in the human way. and people weren't acknowledging me or weren't noticing me. Like, they came and sat at my feet and talked to each other, but never acknowledged me. And they took off their coats and they dropped them at my feet, and then they went off and danced on the dance floor. And so I started to feel the grief of being a tree around people who won't communicate, and without words, because the tree doesn't have that kind of words so much, although I have had the experience of hearing plants speak inside my head. So just a lot of different pieces sort of came together and reminded me of that particular experience.
From your experience as a tree, can you share anything with us about how the tree would have liked to have been acknowledged?
Oh yeah, I thought I was starting to get there. At least was that there was full of grief from the point of view of the tree. It's like, I want to communicate with people and I want to interrelate, and I wish they would just notice me or touch my bark or look at me and appreciate what a tree looks like or smells like or feels like or sounds like and notice what I was doing. Like, to me, I wasn't moving very much, but it felt
lovely.
Significant.
Thank you. You're describing sensory connection. Touch me, smell me, see me. Yeah. The trees want us to be. Thank you for that. That, to me, that description, which I'm taking as coming from the tree people, through you, right, is just reinforcing what we do. So thank you for that. We're at our time, at our closing time, right?
Thank you.
Yeah, so I really want to express my gratitude to all of you for showing up, for sharing what you've shared, for bringing the questions that you have and the willingness to be here. And yeah, I hope to see you on the trail sometime, and if I don't, happy trails to you wherever you are.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you on behalf of Many Rivers. Thank you all for coming tonight on behalf of Many Rivers. Just a couple of brief announcements. We have a donation bowl, Donna Bowl, over on the counter there, and we encourage you to contribute to it, because we split that with our speakers to further their work, and retain half to help maintain this space for future such events. And I want to point out that a little book, Shinji Miyoku, is right over here on this table, along with the information that Amos was talking about earlier. So do check that out on your way out. And once again, thank you for coming tonight. Thank you. That was really lovely, and so many lovely contributions. Thank you for all those, and thank you on behalf of Many Rivers.
For them.